African Rice Heart, Part 5, Give.
Neither Samedi nor Jolie have asked me to give them anything during my time here. Nothing. This is something really incredible for this culture. It's made me feel like they really respect me. Other people ask me for things all the time. Give me your shirt. Give me your water bottle. Give me your banana. Give me your hair. The little kids here, they like to ask for toys, balloons, or pencils. And I made it my goal to try to teach them that asking for things isn't polite. I explained to them by saying, I want to be your friend, but when you only ask me for things like, give me this, give me that, I just don't feel like I'm a friend. The other day, I gave my speech to a small group of children, and a light bulb went on in the head of one adorable little boy. He said, oh, yes, yes, and he nodded enthusiastically. Then, looking very serious, he said to all the other kids, we shouldn't ask for things. And with that, he grabbed my hand. I was at the market recently, and I purchased a bag of dried figs. When I eat them, I feel like I'm eating fresh produce, and it's almost enough to trick myself into feeling healthy. These figs have seeds in the middle, but the outer layer is like fruit leather. Fruit leather and tiny bugs, which I eat and I don't even think about because I want to eat the figs so badly. As I was snacking on the figs on the walk home, I passed a woman carrying this huge bowl of rice up on her head. She said, give me some. So I reached in and gave her a small handful of figs. Then, motioning to her rice bowl, I said, you give me some. Without a second thought and with a very serious face, she reached up, took out a handful of rice kernels, and poured them into my palms. I was half kidding with her, but she took me seriously and looked rather pleased with herself. Maybe they're trying to say something when they ask for something, such as, show me we're friends, give me something of yourself. Every time I give without a second thought, I make a new friend. And what does it cost me after all? A few less figs to eat? It's easy to be defensive and paranoid about people taking advantage of you. Sometimes I feel stingy. And when I think about Jesus' challenge to live differently, my thought processes go something like this. Love your enemies. Okay, that's vague enough. I think I can do that. Do good to those who hate you. All right, that's not very hard. I mean, he doesn't define good, no problem. Pray for the happiness of those who curse you. Pray for those who hurt you. Yeah, okay, he's just asking for words. Totally doable. If someone strikes you, stand there and take it. If someone drags you into court and sues you for the shirt off your back, gift wrap your best coat and make a present of it. And if someone takes unfair advantage of you, use the occasion to practice the servant life. No more this for that kind of stuff. Live generously. Whoa, I think that's a little bit bigger deal. These verses leave me speechless because they're so hard to get around. They so straight up call me to live differently than the way I do. Give what I have to anyone who asks for it? He couldn't really have meant that literally, we tell ourselves. But inside of me, it's both nerve-wracking and exciting when I think he just might have, because I honestly wonder what the outcome might be. What if we run out of food? What if we give everything we have? What if the fish and bread don't multiply? I'm attached to a lot of things, certain clothes, certain books, certain times of the day. I grip them tightly and hide them behind my back because giving them away would be hard. And I tell myself, come on, Emily, loosen your grip. Soap. I was washing my laundry at the well the other day, and when I finished, a couple of boys came over. They picked up my wet, half-used Holiday Inn bar soap and said that they liked them. I told them they could have them, and when I did, the older boy immediately snatched the bar of soap from the younger boy and told him that he could have his bar, which is smaller. This irritated me. I said, hey, why did you do that? That soap was his. He said, he's younger, he gets the smaller one. I argued a bit with the older boy, telling him, it's better when you give the bigger thing to the other person and take the smaller one for yourself. He just kept shaking his head. So thinking I'd teach him a lesson, I pulled out a brand new bar of soap and gave it to the littler boy. The older boy instantly started reaching for the brand new bar of soap and I said, no, that's not for you, that's for him. I want to give this to him. Finally, I used the word selfish, lisinia, and he got the hint. skin and bone and teeth and eyes. I gave an IM shot today, and there was no M on the little boy. I hate malnutrition. Strong word, I know. He lies there, his existence put into question by his diminishing mass. I ask myself, how? How does a three-year-old come to have ankles the size of my thumbs before the parents see that he's sick? The child vomits up everything that goes into his stomach, and this nausea has killed his interest in food, increasing the problem. As the mother held the baby against her, she took his little arm and straightened it, revealing his little antecubital. I ran my finger along his loose skin, searching for a vein to target. I wrapped the tourniquet twice around the place where his bicep should be, and the small bit of tension I applied seemed like it threatened to snap his bone. The skin folded back on itself, twisting and finding itself pinched by the rubber's grip. How loose those folds were, and how far they stretched away from the baby's frame, reminding me that this baby was never meant to be this small. I keep reminding the little boy's mother that she needs to wash the clothes, wash the drape that she's wrapping him in. I say, take off this shirt, there's vomit on it, get him a different one. The father pauses, thinks for a bit, and then he says, we don't have another one. Ah, you're an idiot, Emily, I think. Blinking long and hard and taking a deep breath, I remember that it's not what they wanted for their baby. Somehow they've just found themselves here. The baby doesn't move but begins to pee on his mother's dress. Neither she nor he will have their clothes washed anytime soon. After their clothing dries, they'll smell like stale urine but will have to endure it. When the IVs are all dripping quinine, vitamins, antibiotics, and glucose, and I have time, I let myself be unrealistic. I think about all the people I could give these babies to back home. I'd buckle them into airplane seats and send them to families who'd be waiting with strollers and pacifiers. This one would go to the Davises. This one would go to my grandparents. I'll bet Carly Brown would take that one, and he'd be a cyclist someday. These friends and family members of mine could nurse the children back to health. But the cries of one of the babes brings me back to reality, back to the situation as it is. I know we can't change the world by moving every human out of the bad parts and into the good parts. We have to try to make the bad parts good. And really, where is truly good already anyway? Oh, but sometimes it's just so overwhelming. I want to put these babies in beds with covers. I want them to sleep in a room that doesn't smell so bad, and I want them to eat food that contains vitamins. Sometimes I realize that the depression that's starting to come out of my accounts of these experiences in Chad is revealing what's starting to just coat my eyes. The suffering I see every day is all I've been able to focus on lately. I've got to peel it back because honestly, there is plenty of joy flooding the hours of the day. I'm determined to write about something happier next time. My boyfriend Alex wrote an email to me. In it, he said that our reality can be changed by our perceptions. When we see something as good, we make it better. And I believe it. There's a song by Reliant K that I listened to today. It's old, but it speaks about the very thing that I've been experiencing lately. All of these things are just building up, and sometimes it's hard to start a day feeling optimistic. But the last line of this song says, today I'll trust you, Lord, with the confidence of a man who's never known defeat. Yeah, the confidence of a man who has never known defeat. My courage and confidence need to be reassessed. Dance your heart out. At night, in the light of the fire, everything becomes more beautiful. The shadows and lights, brights and darks, are almost as pretty as the colors that we enjoy during the day. Last night, I was finishing my porridge, and Crispin, Tony, and Pa Brice were throwing their bodies all over the grass mat, fidgeting, poking me, and nibbling at peanuts. Their attempt at relaxing seemed tainted, or perhaps even fueled, by boredom. Then Jolie came out of her hut, and she walked toward the fire, choosing a spot across from me. She pressed her hands together at chest height, began moving her shoulders rhythmically in circles, and sang Nanjere chants, humming when she forgot the words. Eventually, she added native dances to her performance. The fire was casting her shadow up on the mud wall, and the kids giggled and then rolled with laughter as they watched the shadow's portrayal of their grandmother's dances. Their laughter added fuel to the fire within Jolie. She stopped dancing, told everyone to wait right where we were, and went into her hut. When she emerged, her skirt was tied up between her legs to form makeshift pants, and she had tied a strip of cloth around her forehead that left the ends dangling around. Her new costume seemed to make her all the more animated, and she did kicks with her feet, performed warrior dances with the young three boys, and made me laugh hysterically, which meant, "Encore, encore!" Jolie is the source of so much joy here. It's not just my joy, but that of our whole family. I want to be more like Jolie. Her joy is so contagious, and I hope that I catch it. Attention. I remember when I ran away from home at the age of 8. I went out to the forest back of our house and sat in the pine needles, thinking that someone would notice that I was gone and then send a search party. I sat for what seemed to be a long time. I didn't like being alone or sitting where I had to sweep ants off my legs or where all sorts of pine cones and pine needles poked me in the rear. But I thought the attention I would get was going to make the discomfort worth it. Oh, the moment when they'd find me and feel awful for not bending to my every whim before, I thought. They'll wish they had paid more attention to me. I also remember being a kid and getting in one of those really obnoxious moods in which I hassled my uncle endlessly. He kept me at arm's length, playfully pushing me away while continuing whatever adult conversation he was in. It was obvious that I was asking for something, and finally I just plain demanded it. I yelled, "Give me attention!" African children soak up attention like sponges. I've never seen kids so hungry for it. Little Armel will out of nowhere yell the word, "Yellow!" just because she knows it's English and that I'll look towards her. Pabris will roll in the dirt just so people will grasp the lack of his inhibition. Aaron will call my name and then, realizing he's got nothing to say, he'll make some crazy face just to get a reaction. The kids bring their homework and set it in my lap, balance pots on their heads, pretend they're going to eat frogs, and point to their new clothes, anything to get attention. It seems as we get older, we learn to live with less attention. Or perhaps as we grow older, the world demands so much from us that we just want to escape from its eye. Whatever the case, these kids are still soaking up attention. Letting go of the reins. Yikes! Stefan, Ansley, and I raced the three horses tonight. It raised the exact same feeling that I have when I drive in the fog back in the States. That tossing caution slightly to the wind, no matter how slow you go, you just don't know what will come out of the fog. It's a risky, edgy feeling, one I felt while riding the horse. We were flying. I usually hold the reins pretty tight and try to keep the horse at a steady speed. But tonight, I just let the reins go. It was beautiful. I felt a bit of energy normally suppressed by the tension of the reins that surged into the horse's legs. My only concern was that this horse I'm riding is extremely skittish, and just about anything can set him off. If he sees a bush, he jumps to the side. He hears a baby cry, he jumps to the side. He passes under a tree, and he jumps to the side. So you have to be ready. I felt like a good person for letting him run free. It felt like the right thing to do for a horse. I also felt like I was pushing my luck. Falling off at those speeds could result in broken bones or things being dislocated. Finally, I leaned back on the reins for all I was worth, and as we came to a stop, we were right by the grove of trees. The sun had left us, and so we turned around and took the trail home, arriving at the stables after dark. We pulled the sweaty saddles and blankets off the panting horses and put them away. Contentment. I handed baby Glass to Cecile at 11 p.m. and got up and walked to my hut. I could hear noise coming from the street in front of my house, something that sounded like teenagers. Boys and girls flirting, maybe. First, there'd be a voice telling a joke, followed by a lot of laughter. Then bursts of conversation between many pairs, and then someone would say something to the group as a whole. They were socializing. I swung my hut door open and walked blindly into my pitch black hut. I shuffled my feet along the dirt floor until my shins hit the cot, at which point I collapsed into bed. I waited for the thoughts of home and feelings that I was a misfit to set in, like it happened so many other nights, but they never came. I felt okay. I felt lucky, even. I felt the early symptoms of contentment. My body asked my unusually settled mind, "Is this what you've been waiting for? Is this the beginning of the state of mind you envisioned sinking into?" I couldn't answer that question because the only answer I can really trust is that permanent feeling of contented belonging residing within me. Time will tell. Handle that. I really don't think I can do this. I'm not a nurse. I feel like a second grader on move-up day, during which for one day you get to try out being a third grader. They give you division and multiplication problems, and then they ask you to write haiku poems, things you've never done before. Inside your little challenged mind, you think, "Ugh, I want the teacher to like me. I want to succeed here. I want to be able to be a third grader, but I don't think I can." Last night, I worked night shift. Maybe they should call it eternity long shift because it goes from 3 p.m. to 8 a.m. I was scheduled to work with an incredibly knowledgeable and level-headed Chadian nurse named Augustin, but when I arrived, he was terribly sick with malaria. I don't think he got rid of it the last time he had it. Last night, he was vomiting and shaking with chills when he told me that he couldn't work. Scared at the likely implications of what he said, I begged him not to go home. I can't be the only staff on duty at the hospital. I need someone who I can ask medical dosage questions, someone to receive emergency patients, someone with knowledge and confidence, two things I felt like I was lacking. I told Augustin that he could go sleep and wouldn't have to lift a finger, but please, I said, don't leave me alone. He climbed onto the maternity table in the delivery room, and I gave him my blanket, which he tucked under his shivering body all around. Still, I left the room and shut the door behind me, and as I stood in the hallway, I was just thinking, I really don't think I can do this. The wards are so full right now because after rice season, everyone feels rich and they're all coming to get the long overdue treatments for their health problems. Isolation ward, completely full. Maternity ward, no rooms left. Pediatrics, not a bed open. Women's ward, overflowing. Men's ward, surgery patients galore. I'd come at 3 o'clock thinking that in the evening I'd have a break during which I could run home, get a headlamp, eat a quick bite of something supperish, but I never left the hospital. That child's blood transfusion clotted off. This baby needs diazepam because he's convulsing. This other baby's IV is so infiltrated that the baby has a massive balloon of water under his skin. I need to start the IV for the woman in the emergency room, give the 6 o'clock meds, and take the temperatures of any critical babies. That's all there's time for now. Then I have to run back and forth between the wards and give the 9 o'clock meds. So I never went home. Knowing that I hadn't been able to make it home, Dinga and Esther came to the hospital at 9:30 with a tray holding a cute little pot of oil-soaked pasta covered with a hand-crocheted doily to keep some heat in. I have really sweet sisters. About 10:30 p.m., I thought I might fail. I thought I wasn't capable of doing everything that needed to be done, and then I hit rock bottom. I've decided that was the best thing that could have happened to me right then. When you bounce a basketball on hard ground, it bounces back, but if you don't hit hard, you'll just drag the rest of the night. That night, I had a good little session of prayer, stargazing, and remembering that time after time, these things turn out okay. And I said to myself, "Buck up, Emily, tough it out." The night was still long, and I had a million meds to give between 11 and 1, but at 1:30 a.m., I was able to take care of everything I needed to. Then I lay down on a skinny cement bench outside the emergency room. The bench fits between my shoulder blades, which keeps me from rolling off to either side. I can never wait for the sun to come back in the morning. There's a loneliness that haunts the night shifts. The patients who sleep at night, they sleep hard. The patients who don't sleep are crying or else in so much pain that they just sit or lie in the bed in silence. It's eerie and it leaves me anxious. At 4:30 a.m., I went around and gave the 5 a.m. meds, still pitch black. The battery from my phone was running low from substituting as a flashlight all night long, but as the sun crept up, a wash of peace came over me. I had told myself I would praise God with everything inside of me when I saw the morning light. I look back on it now and I realize that I shouldn't have waited. I should have been thankful at 10:30 p.m., at rock bottom, because rock bottom is what sends us up. Rock bottom makes us different people, stronger, more God-dependent people. I'm pretty sure Augustin needs IV fluids now. There's no way he has any fluid left in him. Collision. Jolie seems to be very, very perceptive. Sometimes, when we're around the fire at night, I let my eyes glaze over. When I do, they can only see little blurry dots in the sky and make out only an orange glow where the coals are burning down. While my eyes are resting, my brain isn't. And the thinking I do, it's so uncontrolled and zoned out. It's easy for me to fall into this situation because I don't understand enough Nanjere to follow a fast-paced conversation of the rest of the family. Jolie will catch me zoning out and ask with a sweet smile, "Emily, what are you thinking about? Are you thinking about Alice?" Then Esther, embarrassed, snaps at her mother, "Mama, every time, Mama." It's true, Jolie can't pronounce Alex's name, and the name Alice has become a funny substitute. Jolie asks me if I've gotten a letter from him lately, and if he's coming to visit. Her questions go deeper, and she asks if we'll marry. I backpedal. If you've ever done that on a bike, you know it takes you nowhere, so I'm forced to move forward and explain. I'll finish my education, get to know him more, and then maybe we'll see. I tell her it will be years. She disagrees and tells me, "No, I'll have children soon." Because she's so certain and I can tell that the thought brings her great joy, I just laugh and don't even argue. She then asks me if I'm thinking about my family. She asks how they're doing and if they're healthy. I ask for the lamp and I run to my hut and bring back a set of pictures. As I go through them, she can't tell the difference between my mother and me, much like I couldn't tell the difference between all my African siblings for quite some time. Jolie handles the pictures with such care, as if they're the people themselves. The children question me about the pictures until I'm tired, because my family back home is so different from them. They imitate the funny faces that my friends are making in some of the pictures and then hold the pictures up so people can compare their imitations to the originals. Each of them is trying to relate and trying to enjoy the things they've never seen. Sometimes I imagine my parents shaking hands with my African parents here in Béré. I imagine the things that they'll have in common. Jolie will show my mom the fabrics that she sells every day at the market, and they'll pore over them and match colors and choose their favorite patterns. My dad would go to the hospital with Samadi, and they might assess patients together or assist each other with procedures. Then I imagine them meeting at my home in America. Jolie would do the dishes with my mom, and my mom would teach her about a dishwasher. That would be strange for sure. My dad would take Samadi to the barn and show him our motorbike, and let him take it for a spin. Samadi would probably ride all over the mountain, but he'd probably stall the engine a lot because Chad is so flat and he's never used a clutch on hills. I imagine the meeting of these two worlds producing a collision of some sorts, and something happening as a result. A whole lot of learning for sure, but something beyond that practical, factual learning. I imagine there would be this deeper understanding of humanity. Please let this be a silent night. Baby born without a hole between his nasal canal and throat. Dr. Appel made one. Baby's doing great thanks to awesome, dedicated parents. Cerebral malaria coma patient woke up tonight. Comas scare me. He's only 20. 18-year-old boy with meningitis. He will recover. 10-year-old boy with meningitis. I honestly don't know if he'll make it. He's so frail and his muscles have contracted so far already. Young girl with nephritic syndrome. Her whole body is holding water and I'm afraid she'll die. The last girl with the same problem died right in front of me. Josephine said things were lapia. Good. She seems to be in good spirits and didn't wail tonight. Her foot is still very infected. We're changing the dressing twice a day now. Sweet little man caring for his wife. She has malaria. He's the best little husband. Another woman with malaria. It's so bad, I don't think she'll make it. And the doctor says there's nothing more we can do for her. Woman recovering from an emergency hysterectomy. She's yet. Her husband will probably send her back to her father and take another wife. Hippo bite. Man was knocked out of his dugout and into the water by a hippo. He escaped with only a big bite out of his leg. Lucky. Baby Adum had a large part of the skin on his belly removed because of infection. Changing his dressing makes me cringe. This is only a tiny sampling of the people who are resting in this hospital tonight. I'm listening to Silent Night on my iPod now, and the words are just echoing around in this little cement nursing station. I change them in my head something like this. Sleep in heavenly peace, babies. Sleep through the night. All is calm. All is bright, Josephine. Let your mind rest for tonight. It's 3 hours later. But I just got back from carrying a woman to the morgue. She was the one who had really aggressive malaria. What a helpless feeling when all you can do isn't enough. She was the oldest patient I've seen yet. Her family will come and get her in the morning. This is the first time I've actually been to the morgue. There's still blood on the floor from the massacre in October. Sometimes this place feels like a real nightmare. A child was born. On the day before Christmas, I was huddled with a girl named Grace around a tiny wire basket. The basket holds about 6 really hot coals that send out a circle of heat. Grace and I surround the basket with our bodies and trapped all the heat that we could between the two of us. I kept an eye on her skirt, anxiously anticipating that her close proximity to the fire will cause her clothes to light up and burns to mark her flesh. We've seen this quite often at the hospital, and I'm starting to worry like an old woman. Sitting there, my mind wandered again, and I thought about Joseph leading Mary and the donkey. That must have been very uncomfortable. And knowing that Mary was feeling the birthing pains and needed to get to a place where she could have the baby. That rush to the hospital on a donkey during the night sounds really familiar. A mother came in the other day to have her baby, and there wasn't time to get her to the delivery room. She delivered right in the emergency room, and a trash can was placed under her to catch all the fluids. The baby came out screaming as though he'd been breathing air in there all 9 months. And Augustine handed me the little wet bundle, and Hortense and I ran over to the maternity ward where we would rub him up, tie off his cord, and put some protective cream in his eyes. Then we'd take all his measurements. Babies can come so fast. I'll bet Joseph felt a lot of responsibility for Mary. I'll bet he was afraid that the baby would come while Mary was still on the donkey, while they were still traveling. Another man came into our hospital with his wife, and for some reason, they didn't go to the emergency room, which is where we usually assess new patients, but instead they came to the medical surgical ward where I was working. He said, "Please, madame, my wife is about to give birth," and he motioned to her, round-bellied and exhausted. The maternity ward was locked, so we laid her down on a bed meant for post-maternity patients. Because I don't exactly know a ton about obstetrics, and I don't exactly have any training in midwifery, I always think that the baby's gonna come in the first 3 minutes after the expectant woman arrives at the hospital. So I like hurry around frantically, calling the midwife, finding the key, and getting the things ready. Then the baby doesn't come for another 6 hours. The husband was quite worried about his wife, which was so sweet, and it made me want to be married. She delivered a few hours later just fine, a curly-headed little boy. Mary must have been so scared. This was her first baby, and first births are hard. I'll bet Jesus' birth was painful, and I'll bet Mary wondered, why in the world did I agree to this? And Jesus' birth, what a crazy story for us nowadays in America. But people are still giving birth in mud huts here in Africa. Mothers still arrive at this hospital on donkeys and ask for a place to have their baby. I'm excited about tomorrow. Christmas is bound to bring joy.
You've been listening to African Rice Heart, a young woman's journal of radical service. It was written and read by Emily Wilkins and published by Pacific Press Publishing Association, copyright 2011. Join us again next time as it continues.